find comfort.
There we go. You know, I'm talking and you can't hear me. And it's all because of pilot error. I pushed the wrong button. But here I am. I know you're thrilled. Try to contain the excitement. I understand. It is a thrill beyond compare. But here I am. My guest, as I said, is the strange and unexplained, Joe Montaldo. He's been with us before, and he's a friend of this show. And he's my friend, and it's always a pleasure to have him with us. Joe, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
Well, thank you, Kevin. You know, I always love coming on, man. It's you're like one of my all-time favorite radio show hosts, so it's always a pleasure to come hang out on your show and come chat with you. I always enjoy being here.
Well, thank you. Now, Joe is in New Orleans, Louisiana, and folks, all I have to say is New Orleans, and you instantly think food, music, largest harbor in the USA, sports, you know, the New Orleans Saints. And we also think Katrina because, and you know, I guess one of the biggest news stories in our lifetime, Katrina. And then right along with Katrina, the BP oil spill. Joe, how is the city doing now after Katrina and after the BP oil spill? How's the city doing?
Well, you know, I've seen it better. You know, now that we got a new mayor, I got to give him credit. Things are looking better that way. So he's doing a much better job than the other guy was. Actually, he's cleaning up the city, getting rid of some of the corruption. So that's a good thing. But we're still short 1.5 million people, maybe closer to 2 million. So, you know, there's jobs here and there's places to live here. But being that there are so many people missing, it's making the money here more scarce for the people that are here working right now. So, and frankly, you know, people heard about BP. They're thinking like, oh, New Orleans is contaminated from the oil spill. I'm like, no, guys, we're a good 100 miles from the Gulf.
Yeah. Well, you know, I know the city faces some real challenges because of those disasters, and particularly Katrina. But I just want to say that, you know, it's one of my favorite cities, and I certainly wish the best for everyone there. And I want to say to all you folks listening on FM 105.7 tonight in New Orleans, congratulations for being so smart, listening to the absolute best radio station in the city. You ought to be listening to it every day, 24 hours a day, and but most especially right now when the Kevin Smith
That's
Show
right.
is on.
That's
and
right.
Joe, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for carrying the show for these years on the UPRN and now on the FM 105.7. I appreciate it.
Yep. You know, what's interesting about that, too, Kevin, there's a group in May that will be picking up the whole station as an overlay in New York. So it's going to be New York and Vermont. They're going to hear us on FM. And then a gentleman who owns a Christian broadcast network in Memphis, Tennessee, mm-hmm. took the whole station and laid it over the over his Christian network. So it's still called a Christian broadcast network, by the way. But uh-huh. they play us 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Oh, so we're being heard in Memphis, Tennessee now.
Yeah, on FM as well. So that's been interesting. And then, of course, you know the rest of us, all these little pirates out there on Shoutcast. And, you know, so we're on all of those, too. You can't count them. They're pirate stations.
Well, look, in fairness, there are, you know, on some of those small little radio shows, they're little small startups. There's some pretty good talent in some of that.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it's just a matter of time, and they'll be big. You know, I like to give credit where credit's due because I started at zero. And I got told when I started, I had money. And now that I'm doing this, I don't have any money. But
I know that feeling.
Yeah. But anyway, I had money, and I contacted two different consultants in New York City, radio consultants. And I wanted to hire a consultant to help my show become big and become big quickly. And the first consultant told me I didn't have a prayer, and the other one told me I didn't have a snowball's chance in hell.
So, I love that
time. I remember what it's like to be at zero and to have, you know, the big boys saying, you don't have a chance. I remember that. And there's some of these startup shows that maybe some of the big boys think they don't have a chance, but I know they do.
Well, I remember the days, Kevin, when 100 archive hits a month, I was happy about. Now I'm praying that we don't go down. Last 6 months in a row, they have brought my archive server down. This month was the worst, 14 days. We even re-upped it three down, so it was down for a total of 10 days. We, on two shows twice, we got 3 million downloads overnight.
Wow.
I was like, you got to be kidding. And which, by the way, I'm really happy about, but I'm kind of frustrated too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, a few challenges go with success as well.
Oh, yes.
Joe, let's talk about ICAR.
Okay.
Last time you were here, we didn't talk about ICAR. I want to talk about ICAR. Look, everybody knows MUFON. They know MUFON is, that's who you call if you see a UFO, right? People instantly think of MUFON. But MUFON doesn't delve into the abduction, alien abduction experiences, and they will tell you so. But ICAR does both. ICAR, mm-hmm. In fact, ICAR does more than both. So introduce us to ICAR.
Well, ICAR is the International Community for Alien Research. It was founded roughly around 2000. It was actually founded in 1998, but the actual idea itself didn't take off till 2000. What happened here is we were all frustrated. I worked for MUFON for 12 years as a lead investigator for them. I was well trained by MUFON. I spent a lot of my own time and my own money with them doing investigation work. My wife was a research analyst for them, which is not an easy position to get with MUFON. And so we were there. We were being groomed to take over as the section director and Louisiana state director. But frankly, when around just before Ed Walters came in, around 89 or 90, there was a lot of stuff going on down here in the South. And we were putting in data. Literally, sometimes 50, 80 abduction cases a week, sometimes 200, 300 sighting cases in a week. That were coming through, and we were getting nothing back. I mean, nothing back. Not even, oh, hi, Joe, thanks for sending in the data. And this went on for roughly a year and a half, 2 years, and I met a group of people on the Internet, thank God for the Internet, by the way, and got to talking to them, and they said, well, you know, maybe we should try to do something new, and a few of us got together and found that ICAR. And then we decided, because of the good old Poise Club in ufology and MUFON itself, we needed to be able to do abduction research. We needed to give the contactee a safe harbor, a place they could come, not be ridiculed, discuss their stuff, and if they wanted to go public with it, they had people behind them to back it. Now, that was 10 years ago. Today, we are by far the largest UFO abduction organization in the world, 30,000 members plus. We boast at least, even if I downplayed the count as much as possible, there's at least 10,000 contactees that are part of the ICAR organization. I was talking to a friend about this today. Just today alone, I have talked to 16 contactees, all investigated contactees, by the way. So it puts ICAR in a very, very unique position, hence why my Oregon State Director, November Hansen, started the personality study, the gray study. Right now she's working on she just wrapped up the personality study. She's going to be making that public in a couple of weeks. She's working on the reptilian study right now. I'm getting ready to introduce part two of the blood type study next month, actually in May. And so the organization's very unique in the way it does things. One, we've had 10 years to do comparison studies of literally thousands of contactees, so we do have abduction criteria now. We do keep some stuff secret, I'm not going to lie, and we always will, because I got to be honest with y'all. There's a lot of good hoaxes in the world today. There's a lot of good fakers out there, and the Internet makes it way easier to portray hoaxes. So we're keeping some data to ourselves.
Well, that's a smart move.
What anybody else does.
Yeah. That's a smart move. You've got to have some things that only you know about. And that way it helps you to spot somebody that's fabricating.
Of course, it drives my director crazy when I won't tell him some of it. Some of the directors know more than others, but frankly, I'm not in a rush, Kevin, so I figure directors should have a couple of years to mature in their position, not be rushed in a 3-month. Well, let's just throw you into this course and poof, put you out on the road. No, I don't want to do that. Because I need to know, first off, foremost, they got to sign a non-disclosure agreement to be a director for ICAR. Anybody, matter of fact, who works for the organization has to sign a non-disclosure agreement. And it's not because ICAR makes any money or we're selling anything. We need to guarantee anonymity to any contactee or abductee that comes to our organization looking for help. We want them to know, without their permission, this will never, for any reason, be made public. Mm-hmm. Ever. And, you know, so live and learn. I mean, it's there's been some drawbacks and some pluses, but today I got to say, I know in the last 5 years I have learned more about alien abduction contact than I did in the first 25 years.
All right, well, let me ask you a question, because we're talking about years, and you've obviously been at this now for a number of years.
30.
How many?
30.
30 years.
30 years, yeah.
Okay, so you've been at this for a while. Just in the last couple of years, there have been thousands of UFO sightings reported around the world. Thousands. Just in the last couple of years, and your organization has 30,000 members plus, and then in addition to that, there are some other organizations, MUFON, I don't know how many they've got, but everybody knows about them. MUFON's out there. And there are some other organizations, and organizations around the world. So there are tons of investigators out there looking into these UFO sightings. There have been thousands of UFO sightings in the last couple of years. Pile all of this together and all the years of experience, are we any closer to knowing the who, what, when, where, why, and how of UFOs than we were, say, 10 years ago?
Yeah, we're much closer. And now, I don't want people to take this out of context. If there's 100%, if there's scale from 0 to 100%, ICAR itself probably knows anywhere from 13 to 20%. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot, but in the grand scheme of all of this, I doubt the government knows more than 5 or 10%. And I don't think most contactees know more than 2 or 3% at best. That's why we call them pieces of the puzzle. For us, it's a little different. The government does MIL-LAB research so that they can come behind organizations like this ones and other ones that have contactees that are especially advanced contactees like we're doing a series with right now. Those kind of contactees the government's really interested in because these are guys that have gotten information. Well, we don't just have one or two or three. Right now, we have a category called keepers. There's 100-plus of those in our organization.
What is that?
A keeper is someone who has come to terms with their abduction and their contact, someone who is more willing to participate with some of the stuff that goes on board ship. They're used for things like, you know, carrying high-tech babies, dealing with stuff like that, dealing with when they're bringing humans and children on and off the ship on board and stuff like that. So they're pervy to a lot more of the information, and they're also pervy to some of what like people like Jim Sparks and Kay Wilson and others would call alien gifts. Things like the teacher that allows them to absorb X amount of knowledge, the things that allows them to be downloaded when they're down here on Earth. So these people are very advanced, and what's really nice about is they're very consistent. Now, we have these people all around the world. Matter of fact, right now in the 20-series special we're doing, the first 5 guests were from Europe. Just to put them in context, we don't just do the United States. Our contactees are worldwide based. Right now, I think we have contactees in more than 100 countries. So it gives us a very unique view on everybody. So we got this lady down here in South Africa with her 5 or 6 friends. They're having abductions. We've got a gentleman up in the Ukraine having abductions. We got someone over in the Soviet Union having abductions. We got someone in the UK and France, Germany, Italy, and we got some in Africa.
Hey, Joe.
South America.
Joe,
so,
guess what?
Yeah.
You don't have anybody in the Soviet Union because there is no Soviet Union.
Sorry. I did say that, didn't I?
You did.
Well, I meant Russia, guys. I'm sorry.
Your age is telling. Your age is telling. You're talking about the Soviet Union. You know, there are people listening to this show who cannot remember the Soviet Union.
I know.
That's awesome, isn't it? Unbelievable. All right. Well, now you deal with pretty much the whole package. I mean, you deal with the alien or the UFO sighting, but you also deal with alien contact and abductions. All right, we've got a couple of minutes here before break, so let me ask you this. How many alien races are visiting the Earth that ICAR has been able to confirm some way?
Okay, we got the grays. By the way, there's several varieties of the gray. There's not just one type of gray. There's actually several varieties of the grays, but we'll get into that later. But there are. There's the reptilians and the humans, which, by the way, there's varieties of those as well. There's little brown guys, which we don't even want to talk about if we don't have to because they're pretty nasty. There's Charles Hall's tall whites. Now, that's borderline because I've only had four other witnesses, granted good ones, state troopers that were in a casino when this happened, so they're pretty good witnesses. But still, there's only four of them, so we're borderline there. There's light beams, which are confirmed by several different groups. So for us, there's five, six if you count the there's this other thing that goes on. But other than that, We have a hard time buying when we hear people like Dr. Greer say, well, there's 56 types. I cannot find no evidence of that. And not only that, we can type the ships to the alien and the locations. So now we know that, you know, this type of aliens with this type of ship, this type of aliens with that type of ship. So there's only X amount of ships seen. There's not like there's hundreds of different types of ships being seen. Mm-hmm. There's only a few varieties. So there's just no real proof other than their word that says that's going on. And frankly, I'll tell you, I don't know now.
You forgot the secret?
No, you know how I am. I get those urges to tell secrets. See, I got like 55 IMs when we went to break. What secrets? You can't be telling our secrets. I'm thinking, I'm like, no, directors, come on now.
Okay, look, you said there are the grays.
Mm-hmm.
There are the humans, the reptilians, the tall whites, the small browns, and the light beings. Now, you know, I think most of us know a little bit about all of these, except mm-hmm. a few people would not know, or would know something about the little brown guys. But why don't you tell us about that? What's up with them? You didn't seem like you really were too impressed with them.
Well, you know, I had seen when I seen Travis Walton in Fire of the Sky, which, by the way, that scene where the little brown guys are dragging, little rinky-looking guys are dragging him through the ship isn't a real scene in his abduction. I just wanted people to know that. But there are aliens that look a lot like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they look about the same size, look about the same color, but they're really, really wrinkly. They look like really short, really, really, really old people. We call them the cleanup crew. And the reason why, the only places they're ever seen is like if there was some kind of problem that needed to be cleaned up, removed, or taken away, or if something had died, or something like that, that's what they do. Now, there's rumors floating around that they actually eat whatever they're cleaning up. I cannot verify that in any shape, fashion, or form, but, you know, there's quite a few contactees that would swear by it. I just haven't been able to authenticate it, but we do know they exist because they have been seen now probably by about 200 or 300 different contactees that were involved. And if you've ever heard Jim Strzok speak, he talks about different kind of programs that they put you through. These are the same types of programs. It's just sometimes things go amok, and these guys are needed for that particular reason. They don't really sound very nice, and they don't really sound very friendly. So we just don't like them. And there's not very much information on them, just little tiny bits. The light beings is quite a bit. The grays, the reptilians, the humans. It's like the reps. The reps get such a bad rap. And they're not even reptilians, they're amphibians. And they get such a bad rep, you know? I mean, they're supposedly almost an agrarian society, so I don't know why they get such a bad rep. But here's one for you, Kevin. While we've been doing all these blood type studies and some other stuff, I've always wondered why humans have such an abnormal fear or phobia towards reptiles. I mean, most reptiles are harmless unless it happens to be a moccasin snake or an alligator or something. I mean, most of them are harmless. So I've always wondered what the big fear was, and it's an abnormal fear. It's in 70% of the population worldwide. And the only thing I can come up with is it must have been inbred into us because there doesn't seem to be any real reason for it. And then here's another one for most people don't realize is, if you've ever read Hitler's book, Mein Kampf, you'll notice there's a segment he's talking about the people who used to tell him how to do his genetic experiment and what to do and stuff like that. He used to describe them as great fair-haired angels. Okay, well, the description is a lot like what we consider the human aliens to look like. And they don't look exactly human, but it's enough that it kind of freaks you out. And they do kind of have this thing about them. Well, think about this, guys. These guys were giving advice to Hitler. And y'all are all thinking they're peace, love, and light. I would rethink that if I was y'all. The evidence suggests otherwise. And actually, for most real abduction cases we're dealing with them, they're quite a bit nasty. They even kind of make the Greys look a little nice. And you know the Greys just don't care. I mean, it's not that they don't care. It's just the way they do things. It's very nonchalant.
Well, Joe, let me play the other side of the fence for just a moment on these humans not being a very nice bunch. Because they gave this information and technology and stuff to Adolf Hitler. From the other side of that argument, those people say, well, you know, Hitler took what they were giving him and he misused it, and so they did things to assist in bringing him down. So they, you know, of course that means they made a mistake, and a lot of people think, well, these guys are so smart they'd never make a mistake. If that were true, they'd never crash. So from that side of the fence, the argument would be, well, they are good people, they are nice. Hitler sort of betrayed their trust.
Yeah.
So what would you say about that?
I would say that would be true if that's the only time in history they show up doing this. The Sumerian text talks pretty bad about them. The Egyptians talk pretty rough about them. The Mesoamericans really talk bad about them. Get this. The reptilians in the Sumerian, well, I'm sorry, not the Sumerian, in the Dogon, the Egyptian, and almost all the Mesoamerican tribes are worshipped as the bringer of life. When the humans are considered to be the bringers of death. So you figure it out. I mean, it's throughout our whole culture. Not until modern times, after Christianity started, did this flip. Prior to that, the reptilians in all cultures were revealed. It wasn't until after modern-day religion did this flip-flop, because we started thinking of the Mesoamericans as savages. So any of their beliefs, of course, were wrong. Even though this had been going on for 4,000 years prior to us, the ancients knew what was going on because the aliens were much more open back then. Mm-hmm. And the Sumerians will tell you this. Well, they can't tell you now, but if you go back and go through the text, they talk about two great white dome cities that these aliens built here. And these aliens were human-looking aliens. Not like we look, but, you know, sort of like we look. They said they created another race of aliens just like yourselves that could live and breathe on the planet because they couldn't breathe outside the domes on the planet. That race, some millenniums later, decided that, well, wait, we're just as advanced as they are. We're deities. Why in the hell are we doing the plowing the field and harvesting and working the mines? They started what the Sumerians call the seven creations of man, which happened to run concurrently through several of the ancient cultures. You'll like the bird man and the wolf man and the dog man. I mean, this is something you find in Sumerian Egypt and even in Mesoamerica. So there seems to be a strand running through this. But in the end, the last creation of man was humans, but not modern-day humans. They were, like the Bible describes Adam and Eve, they were not really bright. They knew they could procreate. They could, like, plow the field, they could cook, but they really didn't question why they were here or what they were doing here. If you ever remember the Bible story, the first thing Eve does after the serpent gives her the apple and she bites it is she gets dressed. And why did she get dressed is because she realized she was naked to work. She became self-aware. The Sumerians started this story. They said that the reptilians used to come in and steal their women and rape their women. And when the children were born, they were different. They didn't look different. They acted different. They became self-aware. They're like, oh, you screw you. You plow the field. We're not plowing the field. That's just not going to happen. Hopefully the bleep caught that. But that's just not going to happen. So you can follow this through the Dogon and then through the Egyptians as well. Actually, you should follow them into the Egyptians, then into the Dogon, because that was a progression in the Middle East at the time, which is where the cradle of life was at that time. So this is all real clear. I mean, it's in our history. It's just most people don't want to look. And we tell everybody the same thing. If you're going to get into this field, really get into this field, you have to start in ancient history and work your way forward if you're truly going to get any understanding of what's going on, because this has been going on for a very long time.
Well, you know, you bring up something that is interesting, and a lot of people would not know this. But there is a verse in the Bible that even speaks of the reptilians as being super smart. It says, be as wise as the serpent. Now, people think of snake, but that's not the word. It's nakash, and it just means reptilian.
Yeah.
A snake is a reptile. But not all reptiles are snakes. So be as wise as Nakash, as the reptilian, but as harmless as doves. And so even there, you've got a reference to the reptilians being really smart. In Mesoamerica, Quetzalcoatl was the winged serpent, upright serpent, God, or reptilian God, and he's the one who brought education and wisdom.
What was the sun god called again? That was the snake god, though. I can't remember what he called him. Doggone it.
In Mesoamerica, I don't know. But in China, the dragon, which is there, we say dragon. If we were translating their word into Hebrew to make it fit with, you know, equal what was said about that reptilian in the garden, they say dragon. The Hebrews say nakash. But the dragon is the bringer of wisdom and the bringer of education. The same is true throughout Asia. The dragon or the reptilian is the bringer of wisdom.
The reptilians, as best I can tell, are throughout all of the ancient world. So, and like you were just saying, or we were just talking about it, it seems like that they're in the old world they're portrayed in a much better light than they are in the new world. It just amazes me. It's like the humans got some really good PR in the last 2,000 years. Maybe that's religion. I don't know.
Okay, now. You've made several mentions of the blood type study.
Mm-hmm.
Have you found anything in this blood type study that is particularly interesting that would point towards extraterrestrial intervention?
Well, that would be an argument on where do we think green eyes and Rh negative came from.
Okay.
Most people don't know this, but about 20,000 years ago or 25,000 years ago, we developed Rh negative, which, by the way, Rh is for the rhesus monkey. Rh negative has nothing to do with the rhesus monkey, but Rh positive does. It shares a common strand. What's interesting about this is it didn't show up until 25,000 years ago. Coincidentally, it allowed for the universal donor type, which happens to be O negative. It only makes up 7% of the world's population, but O negative people can give blood to anyone, even AB negative. They can give blood to anyone, but they can only take blood from an O-negative person. Well, recent doctors in World War II would tell you without the universal blood type, we would have lost tens of thousands of soldiers in both the last wars. Okay, so why this coming on the planet, and not just that, it's done a lot of things. It's saved humans in a lot of areas. It's one of the things. It's also one of the things that it made us have to develop the minus D vaccine, which one day we'll get into that. But one of the things we learned from this was, is remarkably, almost 50% of our contactees, about 47% of our contactees, happen to be O negative and green eyed. But yet that only makes up 7% of the world's population and weight. Almost 64% now of our abductees are Rh negative, which still only makes up 15% of the world's population. See, there's definitely a trend here, and it's definitely moving in a specific direction. And I just didn't expect to find that, Kevin, because of you know, I knew what the blood types were. You know, O positive 36%, O negative 7%. You know, the A positive, I think, is like 32% or something. So, you know, I was expecting to find abductions to follow suit with the blood types, but that's not what we found at all. And we may have figured out which aliens gave which blood types to the bloodline. Maybe. There's some stuff we still got to figure out about Mesoamerica yet, but Europe, we're almost 100% sure now.
All right, we're going to step away for a break. And I don't do what you did in this last break. Now, you forgot what you were talking about. I've made a note here, and I'll help you remember when we come back from break. But I want to pick up right here and talk about these blood types and what you found out when we get back on from break. Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking this evening with Joe Montaldo. He is the director of ICAR. We'll be back.
Contact, you've seen that. You know what their eyes look like. And that's what I'd be interested in hearing from a contactee, but I'm getting off track here.
Okay, but no, you're doing exactly what I want you to do, and that's describing these varieties of the grays, which, as you said, they're not really gray. All right, so where do they come from?
Now that's the $55 million question there. When we ask contactees to ask them this, because what we do with contactees and keepers, especially with keepers, we ask them before they go. Usually we'll give them a question, or sometimes they'll write to me and say, "Hey Joe, I know you've been looking for this answer. Can it, like 10 of us get together and pose this question?" So what they do is before they go to bed at night, every night they'll start repeating this question in their head. Sooner or later, when they get picked up, when they realize they're being abducted and the gray grabs them, it's almost instantaneously they will transmit the question to the gray. A lot of times the gray will just answer without thinking about it. Now, I've got to be honest with you contactees out there. Sometimes there's a punishment for it and leave it at that because you catch them off guard. And they don't expect you to do that. And then when they do and they answer you, then they do show emotion from time to time. And on those kind of occasions, they will. But then sometimes people have told me they act like proud parents, like, "Oh, did you see that? He got into my ear." So it's a weird mix there. And I would – something else I don't think most people realize about the grays, they've been abducting us for 10,000 years, the same family lines. So the gray that's picking you up today is probably the gray that picked up your great 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 grandmother way back 5,000-6,000 years ago. So they have a vested interest in these families.
Why?
What people understand, you know, that it's whatever they're actually doing. And I gotta say that judging by their actions, they're not here to save us, but they're not here to kill us. They seem to have a finite interest in us in things in areas that you got to wonder why.
Yeah, well, let me ask, why are they picking on certain families?
It probably has something to do, Kevin, with the original introduction of the alien DNA. See, this argument is, and nobody knows for sure, was there already a human race here when the humans found us? And then they bred with us, and then the reptilians bred with us, and then the grays got involved. Well, any way this goes, at this point, it doesn't matter. We have at least two alien races in us. So somewhere in the future, we're going to surpass both of these races if we don't wipe ourselves out. If it's true that the grays have now intervened and got into our DNA as well, then we have three of the most advanced races in this galaxy mixed in with us.
All right, we're going to step away for a break, Joe. And ladies and gentlemen, we've got a whole bunch more to cover with Joe Montaldo when we get back from this break. If you absolutely have to tear yourself away from the radio to go get a cup of coffee, now's the time. My friends, stick with us for the whole show. I hope you will. We'll be back. All of the music used here at the Kevin Smith Show is from independent artists. Most of it from independent artists at MusicAlley.com. Go over to MusicAlley.com. Check out thousands of artists and thousands of great independent tunes. MusicAlley.com. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you joining us just now in this second hour, welcome aboard. I'm glad you're here. My sincere sympathy to you for whatever kept you from the first hour. We are talking this evening with Joe Montaldo. He is the director of ICAR. And Joe, I at the beginning of the show, I said that stands for International Center for Abduction Research, and you said International Center for Alien Research.
International Community for Alien Research.
Community, okay.
Yeah,
International Community for Alien Research.
What's his name? I'm going to say his name.
Okay. Well, I apologize for the misidentification. All right, now, when we went away for break, I had asked the question, these grays, where do they come from? And you were working on answering that.
Well, if we go by what the contactees say, and this is strictly by what the contactees say, and there is no evidence for this before either write to you, Kevin, or I, there's about 300 or 400 gray contactees that seem to think that they work directly for the light beings. They're here to make sure whatever's going on stays friendly, because apparently the reptilians and humans really don't like each other, which seems to be a common theme throughout history here on the planet, so it makes sense to me. They're really here to oversee. They're supposed to be the light beings' policemen, for lack of a better way of saying it. And they're all supposed to be part of some big, huge council somewhere, and the whole nine yards. Now, a lot of that, I have no doubt, is probably true. It's just, for me, I'm a much more fundamental researcher, and I'm trying to stick what's here on planet Earth. You know, what I can, it's tangible, and I can see. Because I have lots of pictures of this council, and it's eerily strange, because people will portray the council with 15 on the bottom, and then spirals running all the way up. If you've ever seen the last of the Star Wars movies, when Yoda's in there fighting the Emperor and they're in that council room, mm-hmm. they say it looks a lot like that. Except at the top, there's a big dome bowl that's full of water that hangs in there, and it's where all the, I guess, all the amphibians come hang out, or all the aquatics come hang out. But they said it's literally, it's on a planet that's completely water with one giant city that floats around on a dang planet. What gets me is all these contactees draw this, and we didn't even start talking about this until about 2 or 3 years ago. They draw this like, you know, they're seeing it, and the drawings are so close between the abductees and contactees that you got to kind of wonder, you know, is there some validity to this comparison study?
Okay, now a couple of questions. You talked about the grays changing colors when they eat. You talked about them taking off their eye patches. How do you know about that? How do we know that?
Because we contact each. we ask. See, these are questions. This is what drove me crazy, and it's another reason ICAR got founded, because no one were asking these questions. These are fundamental research questions. What does the grade look like? Do you have any? Matter of fact, here's a good one. A contactee of mine just wrote into me the other day, and she had told me about an experience, and I asked her about, could she tell me what the environment felt like? How did it smell? Was it hot? Was it cold? Was there humidity? Was there not? Once you start training contactees to realize these things, they become just a ton of information because they get abducted. Even when they're being abducted, subconsciously, they're now paying attention to their environment, what the aliens look like, if the aliens are interacting with anything, what kind of the environment they are inside of the room. So we start asking fundamental questions. Well, as they start to observe, you know, the grays, now they're paying attention, they'll notice that the grays don't have the patches on when they're doing a lot of the work on them. You know, before they were too scared to open their eyes. Now they're looking, you know, because it took us like 10 years to get a description of a gray's foot. It was driving me crazy. I wanted to know what their feet looked like. And forever, it took, finally, now we've got about 75 contactees that have seen it. When they flip, the floors and the walls are so slick or smooth that they're reflective. And when it's a bright lit area, they can actually see them. So we started learning about that. But it's questions that have to be asked, like the eye colors of any of the aliens. Have you ever heard of research back in the day say what color eyes they got?
No.
Or what types of pupils they have? What shape are the eyeballs or cells? Do they
you know what?
An eyelid?
Listen to this. I had not thought about it till you just mentioned it. What did their eyes look like, and the pupils of their eyes, and so forth? Dr. John Mack, mm-hmm. I know you're familiar with Dr. Mack.
Yes, I am.
Dr. John Mack, at the time he was run over and killed by a drunken driver, was making a movie, and they had to finish this movie without him. But he does appear in the movie. He had shot a great deal of it before they before this happened. But they had to finish it without him. And one of the groups of people that he goes and interviews in this movie, and it's not fiction, it's a documentary, but one of the groups of people he goes to interview, and I know you know about this case over in Africa, where the school children in South Africa,
yes.
All those school children saw the UFO and saw the extraterrestrials. In that movie, he's talking with one of the children who says he had the pupils of his eyes were white. So he described the, you know, having seen the pupils of one of the aliens' eyes, and I had never heard that before.
Yeah, and actually, and it's not even a pupil; it's like a protective coating that comes down when they're in bright areas.
Mm-hmm.
Found that out thanks to several contactees and a couple of kids, by the way. When I actually heard that, I was like, damn, because it just fit into what we were doing. John Mack was decades ahead of himself. And if you could ever find any fault with the man, it was probably because he was just asking questions that today would be considered leading, but back then they were probably right on the money. See, we had to learn from somebody. Like, when people get mad that I changed the Betty and Barney Hill thing, but frankly, those researchers really weren't asking the right questions. They weren't doing the right research. And the hypnosis wasn't a very good regression session. I've heard all the tapes.
You got to give them credit because, I mean, it had never been done before.
That's my point. So they're going to make mistakes. Just like I was saying this to a friend of mine last night. The thing about it is even we, probably half or more of what we're doing is going to end up being mistakes 50 years from now when some other researcher is going, you know, that Joe guy really was good, but, you know, he misread this or he didn't have these things that we have now. Well, that's the same thing with them. I mean, today we're working off of everybody's research. Everybody
sure.
who did Betty and Barney Hill, John Mack, Bud Hopkins, David Jacobs, these were all basic fundamental abduction researchers. Now, granted, how much is wrong, how much is right could be debated till the cows came home. But they did do the legwork, the initial groundwork, which allowed us to take all of their data and all of their research and incorporate it in what we're doing and what everybody else was doing and come up to where we are today, which is a much different thing than where the rest of the field is today, because frankly, They just don't have the amount of information that we do. It's really kind of unfair today because the organization's in a very unique position. Having as many contactees that we work with on a daily basis really puts us in a position all by ourselves because, frankly, there's nobody out there doing it. And not to take away from any of my friends because, you know, you have Yvonne Smith and Mary Rodwell and Daryl Sims and several other friends of mine that do research out there are damn good researchers. But, you know, they don't have the resources that we do, and they definitely don't have the contact details that we do. And actually, you know Melinda Leslie.
Yes.
She's on my list because she's the one that got me in the Mill Labs, which her, I love her to death. Oh, I got to give her a free plug, man. She's just starting that Skywatch down in Sedona, Arizona. God, y'all should go down there and check it out.
You know, that's where I met her. I met her at a conference, at a Skywatch conference in Sedona.
Yes.
And, she's been on the show. Okay, what do we know about light beings? I hear that all the time, but what do we really know about these guys?
Most of it, Kevin, I got to be honest, is myth, lore, legend. Supposedly, they are the shapeshifters because the Greys, the reptilians, and the humans do not shapeshift. That is a big load of you-know-what. But the light beings are supposed to be pure matter or pure energy of some sort. They're supposed to be able to travel through space without a ship. They supposedly can take any form, any time, anywhere by thought. They can produce... In our society, and especially 2,000 years ago, the only way you could have perceived these beings would have been as gods, and very advanced gods at that. Because I'm sure the Greys and the reptilians and all were considered to be some kind of deities back in the day, but these guys would account for a lot of these descriptions we get of glowing beings coming down and things being burnt around them and stuff. Because they're very, and in reality, they're in a sense angelic-like. Because if, like you, if I was just sitting there and you seen this sparkling gold thing or whatever color it may be coming down, and while you feel it, you can feel the warmth from it coming to you and the safeness because it can translate anything that's feeling to you. So there would be no other way to explain these guys. Now, because of the contactees dealing with the aliens, we know that they're not gods. Get me wrong, they're extremely advanced and probably as close to God as you can get without, you know, being a god, but they're not. They're aliens. And they kind of freaked me out a little bit because they don't seem to slap away that they might be gods, is what I guess I'm trying to say. They're not trying to say, well, no, we're not gods. But they don't say that they are, or they just don't deny that they aren't.
Yeah, so if you want to think he's a god, he's okay with that.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a better, much better way of saying it. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so are they at the apex of the power structure, or is there a power structure for the aliens?
If the contactees are telling the truth, which I really think in their heart they are, then yes, they're at the apex of the power structure with the Greys, the reptilians, the light beings, and several other races around those technological levels being the same way. That's what the Council of 15 is supposed to be, the most 15 advanced cultures, I guess, the most 15 advanced races in the known galaxy.
Okay, so the light beings are at the apex. Who's above them? Anybody?
As far as I know, nobody.
Mm-hmm.
But they also say that they're very non-interference, they're very hands-off. But they got the Greys. I guess it can be hands on.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And,
now, I have heard, and I know you have heard, we've seen it in movies, I've read it in books, and I've heard people talk about it, references to the ancients. Is that what we're talking about here? The light beings? Are they the ancients?
They probably are. They probably are what we consider to be the ancients. They're probably who is overseeing this. There's a couple of stories written in the ancient world about beings that came through the galaxy. Most people don't realize that prior to modern-day religion, there were lots of stories about beings from other worlds. You know, for some reason, when the Christians took over, it was a bad thing to talk about other worlds. But prior to that, it wasn't. They talked about other worlds and beings from other worlds. And supposedly, the ancients came here to oversee and help the planet and to help the humans mature without interference, which apparently isn't happening.
Mm-hmm.
because the reptilians. Now, what's funny about this Well, what's scary about this, there's evidence to suggest that Earth isn't even our planet. There's actually quite a bit of evidence to suggest that we're not native from this. Now, there's a couple of approaches to this. One, if you believe in panspermia, well, then the building blocks were brought here and we developed. We're not from here. We came from somewhere else. If you believe God put us here, of course, we came from God, not from here. And if you believe E.T. put us here, we still came from E.T. But any way it goes, we were supposedly not native to here. Now, what's more important about this, and this is really freaky weird, the human body is set to a 24-and-a-quarter-hour day. But the planet only has a 23-and-three-quarter-hour date. The optimal body temperature for a human is 63 degrees Fahrenheit. The average temperature on planet Earth is 73 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, there's something wrong with this. If we naturally evolved on this planet, we should have a 23-and-three-quarter-hour clock, and our optimal body temperature should be 73 degrees. Now, here's the kicker, guys. Mars, 53 million years ago, they believe had a 63-degree overall temperature because of its distance from the sun. Also, Mars has a 24-and-a-quarter-hour day. Now, you tell me how we have the criteria to live on that planet, but we live on this one. There's something really screwy here, and even science doesn't argue that.
So are you saying that we are the Martians?
Well, let's say we probably have a common ancestry somewhere along the line. You know, it's interesting because I heard Michio Kaku talk about this and some other people recently, that the asteroid field between Mars and Jupiter may have been a planet. Now, what's funny about this is it would have been about five times the size of Earth, and it would have crossed our orbit about every 3,600 years, which is funny because that's what they said Nibiru was, a planet about five times the size of the Earth that crossed our orbit about every 3,600 years. Now, what they're saying is Jupiter grabbed this planet, and the tidal forces of Jupiter just ripped it apart. And maybe some when it did, because right at the same time, Venus went ballistic and turned into an oven. Mars lost its atmosphere, and Earth completely flip-flopped and changed all of its life on the planet. All these planets happened at the same time, so there had to be some disaster in the solar system itself that caused this. Even modern-day science are looking at this today. So we're learning that things aren't what we originally were told that they were, that there's more to our history than we started out as a little amoeba somewhere on a planet. It looks like that's not how we got here at all. Now, the reason I'm talking about all of this is there's a map called the Map of the Creator. The Russians have it. A group of archaeologists found it, I think, in the 70s or 80s. The thing about it is it dates back 120 million years. It's an aerial resource map.
I did a show on that.
There's no archaeologist today that argues this point. This map is 120 million years old, and it's taken from an aerial view.
Yeah, and it's a topological map. In other words, where if you were looking at that region from space, where you see mountains, there's a mountain in this map. It's not a drawing, it's a casting.
It is, it actually is. And it's a very significant thing because according to our scientists, there were no humans on Earth. We're less than a 2-million-year-old species.
Mm-hmm.
So who made this map, guys? And nobody's arguing. And see, and there's other things besides that. There's other pieces of our history that date back longer than we've been on this planet, which suggests there was already an intelligent life form on this planet, probably the amphibian reptilians, which makes perfect sense to me because the planet was being ruled by reptilians. The planet's three-quarters water. I would think the dominant life form that evolved here would have used both areas, would have evolved using both areas. And that's what the amphibians are. They live in the ocean or on the land without any problem. So that would make more sense that they're actually from here and we're the invaders. We're always talking about alien invaders, and we're probably actually the alien invaders. We're probably inhabiting someone else's planet who probably left some time ago when the planet got hit by the asteroid. And when they came back, they found what? An infestation.
All right, so let's go back to Mars. If we came from Mars, how? How did we get here?
Well, you know, there's a lot of scenarios, and I've heard several scientists talk about this in recent years, because these are theoretical scientists talking about this. you know, it could have been something as simply, because you know there's Martian rocks all over the planet.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we already know that. And when Mount Olympus was at its pride and blowing up, it was constantly sending debris to our planet. It wasn't that uncommon thing to happen. So here, naturally happened, we've got amoebas and stuff being sent to the planet. Possibly we could evolve that way, and that's why we're kind of off-centered, because, you know, the building blocks came from Mars, and it was set to that planet. More than likely, though, as this planet started to change and Mars started to die, because Mars didn't die overnight. It took several million years for Mars to die. While that was happening, this planet was starting to calm down. I think it was just a natural progression, a colonization move to this planet. I think the humans came here. That's why they couldn't breathe our atmosphere. And remember, that's what the Sumerians said. They couldn't breathe the atmosphere here, which suggests that there was already a human race here when they came, or the renderings of one. So through interbreeding, it's probably why their genes are probably more dominant, is probably what it was initially. God knows what happened since then.
So what you're describing is what we saw in this movie called Mission to Mars.
Yeah, I guess in a way it is. It is, in a way it is. Of course, we came up with the idea 50 years before they did. Still.
Yeah, but you see, the interesting thing about that is the major financial backer for that Mission to Mars movie was NASA.
Oh, was it? I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, are they trying to tell us this is it, folks?
It made a lot of sense, man. I got to say, when you start putting, you know, and I, by the way, so y'all notice, ladies and gentlemen, I have put these theories. I've interviewed Michio Kaku. I introduced this theory and the building block theory to him. I talked with Neil deGrasse Tyson about this very thing, Dr. Paul Lavalette about these things. And you know what, guys? They didn't think it was all that far-fetched of an idea. So if you can get big boys like that to at least acknowledge it, there's hope for us.
Yeah, you know, the only people that poo-poo thinking outside the box are the poobahs.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the grand poobahs of the UFO community that are gods over all the information.
I say this, Kevin, but I would guarantee you half of the people in this field have some kind of government tie, because there's so much disinformation.
I don't. If I had a government tie, I'd be getting a government check, and I guarantee you I could use one. But I hear that. You know, I've heard people say, "Oh, you got to, you know, watch out for Smith because he's an agent." No, I'm not an agent. And you know, one guy said, you know, to another network that carries the show. One guy sent an email to him and told him, you know, you got to watch out for him. He's probably military intelligence. I've never been military anything. And, you know, and I am not attached or working with any intelligence agency anywhere on this planet.
Oh God, I got to tell you this story. Recently, I got an email, and it started out with one person. They said, "I heard, Joe, when contactees joined your organization, that MILAB abduction stopped. What are you, some kind of general for the MILAB?" Next thing I knew, they're all over Facebook and MySpace. Joey runs the MILAB thing. I'm like, oh, my God, come on, people. So I had contactees writing to me, "Well, you're responsible for the MILAB." I'm like, no, guys, it has nothing to do with military abductions. Trust me in this, nothing whatsoever. I said, I'm trying to figure it out, too. And, but it shows you how things get started.
Well, and that's what I refer to impolitely on this show as people with mental road rash.
That's a good way to refer them to them, too.
Yeah.
I like that.
You know, I'm out here, and you are too, busting our rear trying to keep things together so that we can keep getting the information out. We're not getting any checks from the government. We're not getting any assistance from the government. We do get interference sometimes, we think, from the government, or I do. And then, you know, you have some nut that pops up with something like this. And really, you know, I said one time on the air about something like that, I said, you know, they have pills for that. And would you believe I lost, just from saying that, I lost a member who was upset with me because he has to take pills every day.
Mental road rash, folks. Mental road rash.
People take stuff entirely too seriously.
Yeah. All right. Now, I want to go back to the map of the Creator.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to ask you to speculate as to which of these groups made it. Was it? Is that something that was made by the light beings? Was that something that was made by the grays? Where did that come from?
I would want to say it was the amphibian reptilians. If the stories are true and they're native to planet Earth, I think they're the ones that made it. And there's something besides that. A lot of times, contactees describe these great domed underwater areas, not cities, but areas where they contain like libraries and learning areas where the reptilians will bring you and stuff. And there was some stuff when they were describing the map, something with some pictographs or something in the map that made me think when I seen them, because I'd seen them in reptilian drawings from contactees, that made me think that it led a lot of credence to the story that they may actually be from Earth. And that kind of still fascinates me because they're amphibians. They got to come from a water planet. You know, so if they're not coming from here, they're coming from another one, and I'd like to see that just to see another water planet. But they said, according to the reptilians themselves, because we have had contactees ask them, that they left this planet about just, they knew this was coming. They actually left before the disaster happened and colonized several areas, including the Draconian star system. And there's actually a writing in Angkor Wat about that very thing, about the amphibians.
All right, we have to step away for break. We'll be back right after this. And you may remember this. There's a video of this out on YouTube and it's probably some other places. Astronaut Gene Cernan was being interviewed on TV news, and he's talking with the anchor, and the subject that they're talking about has to do with the Obama administration canceling NASA's plans to go back to the moon. And Gene Cernan is expressing his displeasure with that and the fact that he thinks that we're being relegated, in terms of space, we're being relegated to the position of a third world country.
Pretty much.
Okay, now, a very interesting thing happens at this point. The anchor says, well, as you know, not all of the astronaut corps shares your opinion. Buzz Aldrin says he strongly supports the president's decision to not go back to the moon. Okay, at this point now, Gene Cernan is addressing the fact that he's going to address the fact that Buzz Aldrin agrees we do not need to go back to the moon. In the course of addressing that, he says, well, there are some differences of opinion between Buzz and me on several issues, and this would be one of them, but there are many issues we agree on, such as, and he starts listing things that he and Buzz Aldrin agree on, and one of those, he says, Buzz thinks we need to go back to Mars, and I agree with that, and blah, 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 and he lists some more things. Now, just now, whenever you said all three contactees have told me that, I corrected it and said, you mean all three types of contactees? And you said, yes. That's the normal thing a host will do. This anchor said nothing at all. He could not possibly, Cernan could not possibly have meant that Buzz wants to go back to the moon, because he's addressing the fact that Buzz says we don't need to go back to the moon. So it was not a slip of the tongue in the sense of using the wrong word, saying Mars when he meant moon. I think it was a slip of security, because he mentioned Mars and Buzz wants to go back to Mars, and I agree with that. Now, just recently, an Italian journalist by the name of Luca Scatamburlo, who has appeared on this show, has written an article, and it's published, it's on the internet, and this article gives the story of a project, a secret military project, where they went to Mars. And Buzz Aldrin, in this story, in this article, Buzz Aldrin is one of the astronauts that went to Mars, and Scatamburlo includes a photograph that purports to be Buzz Aldrin on the surface of Mars. Now, the sun visor is down, so you can't see the face, but he's got a source that's giving him this information. It's interesting that Scatamburlo has come out with this when Cernan, months ago, said Buzz wants to go back to Mars. And now this story's out there with a photograph. It could be a faked photograph, and Scatamburlo says it could be. He says it hasn't been analyzed yet, but you need to know about this. What does ICAR know about such things? Anything?
Oh, you know, in my early days of research, I met a lot of people who were, you know, supposedly government informants or this. Some of them actually turned out to be what they were, but I had heard a rumor when I was a kid in around 76 that we had done a joint mission to Mars with the Russians, and Buzz Aldrin was involved. And this was in like 76 or 77. I think it was 16, 17 years old at the time. And I wasn't even into this stuff, but I had just, you know, I was with a group of people who were kind of into it in size and stuff, and we had just heard about it. So, you know, I got in the Navy. I got a class 9 security clearance. I was just asking people around, have you heard of anything like this? Do you know about it? Well, one of the petty officers gave me a tape to watch of Von Braun Baum talking about the Mars missions. Okay, in his words, and this is a tape most people can find, this isn't top secret or anything, in his words, the Apollo program was designed to go to Mars. The moon was supposed to be a stepping stone just to make sure the technology worked. They already knew there wasn't nothing on the moon. They already knew, I don't know how they knew, but they already knew there wasn't anything on the moon, or anything that they wanted on the moon, I should say. But the project was designed to go to Mars. Now, he talks about this. Well, we stopped going to the moon, everybody says, because the aliens told us to stay up. It may be true. Or maybe we just wanted Apollo 16, 17, 18, which were already bought and paid for. We wanted to use that for something else. See, because I found this interesting. There was four Apollos left. Only one of them can be found. The other three, they say, have been scrapped and broken to parts and are no longer being used. And the crew that they had the solid rocket bottoms for turned out not to be real. They were similar remakes. And I always thought that was interesting. But more importantly than that, because every time I think about them going to Mars in an Apollo capsule, I'm kind of like, oh my God. But more important than that, at the end of the Cold War, the KGB released several documents that talked about a Mars United States Russian joint mission and a TR-3B, which everybody knows is a black.
Whoa, wait, whoa, 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 Wait a minute. When the KGB released their files, the KGB released their files talking about a joint Russian-American mission using a TR-3B in what year?
It was the second year after the fall of the wall, and when I seen it, I'm like, oh, it's got to be a hoax. And it went around ufology for a little while. It made it through ufology, and everybody's like, no, it's got to be a hoax, got to be a hoax. Even though the three documents all had the official Russian stance, looking at the documents, they looked real. But there was no way to authenticate them, and everybody who told me who they wrote to just said they didn't know anything. They hadn't heard of the document, or they didn't know anything about the document. Was it an accidental release? That was. Remember when the KGB did this three times? They released a ton of UFO stuff. They released some stuff about Chernobyl and that supposable thing that was walking around Chernobyl. They actually released some stuff about that as well. And so they had released a lot. And when I seen it, I just, like everybody else, Kevin, I just assumed it was a hoax. I may have made a bad assumption there. Other than that, I don't know. I haven't seen a document in... I had it at the time on my computer. That was many, many hard drives ago.
Well, you know what's going to happen now. Because we've talked about it, you and I are both going to get email telling us what idiots we are to say that the Russians and the Americans went to the moon in a TR-3B when neither one of us said that. But you'll get email, and I will too.
Oh, yeah.
Let me say this. I thank God, though. I mean this. I thank God for the rational, reasonable, sane people who actually listen to what's said and who send email in. All right. We have to step away for a break. We'll be back right after this.
Hi, this is Anne-Marie from Canada, and you are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
I did it again. I pushed the wrong thing on this. What the deal is here, folks, let me explain these pilot errors here. I'm using a different microphone tonight, and it's a different button than I'm used to pushing and a different slider than I'm used to sliding. And so, you know how it is. When you're an old guy like me, you get in the habit of doing things the same way every time. And, enough. This is Joe Montaldo, and Joe, we were talking about this possibility that there was actually this mission to Mars and that we've already put astronauts on Mars. There are some very interesting, odd things sort of sticking up out of the sand that seem to indicate that. The astronaut Gene Cernan interview on television where he mentions that Buzz Aldrin thinks we ought to go back to Mars, and I agree with that. That little interview is one of the things sticking up out of the sand. This story, this article published by Luca Scatamburlo, where he's giving some information that has been given to him, and he's been able to corroborate a little bit of it, including who the person is that is giving him the information. Some of it, and he puts disclaimers all through his article that, look, you know, I can't say that all of this is true. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that parts of it I've been able to corroborate, parts of it I haven't, but you need to know about it. So there's that sticking up out of the sand. You heard about such a mission when you were very young and not interested in this, and you heard that Buzz Aldrin was, in fact, one of the astronauts that went. And then there's the KGB file release that you just mentioned. What do you think? You think this happened?
You know, I think the biggest clue that Vernon von Braun never got mad on many, many occasions, because I was into the space program when I was younger. I've always been a big space buff, but... When I was very, very young, I've heard him speak about this on many occasions. I mean, this was a lifelong dream of his to go to Mars, and never anywhere, and no one had known him. Everybody even got mad, didn't even get upset when they canceled the space program. Now, this does this sound like a German scientist to you? I'm thinking, not. Germans are very passionate people. I'm thinking, not so much. I'm not really buying this. But badness and other things, I think at some point we have gone. Because for me, and then more importantly, is the overall lack of interest by our country in space. With every other country on this planet, it's got an God-keen interest in space because they know it's our future and where we're going to get our resources from. But the U.S., which is the most powerful, most advanced country to ever exist on the planet that we know of, has no interest. Come on, Obama just canned the whole space program. I mean,
well, now look. In fairness, he hasn't canned the whole space program, but he has canned going back to the moon, and he has canned plans to go to Mars until way, way, way far into the future.
Yeah,
that's true. He has done that.
2014 date scared everybody.
Do what?
That 2014 date scared everybody. That's going to be when Earth and Mars is closest it's been in like 10,000 years. It would only take 3 months to get there with present technology. So I could never understand why we decided we didn't want to go. I mean, this is the opportunity because from this date on, we're just getting further and further and further away from Mars for quite some time. So it doesn't make any sense we wouldn't have took advantage of this. It cuts the trip down significantly. It means less supplies, less fuel. What the hell? Less radiation protocols. I didn't get it. You know, for a country that's so interested in this, or for people that's so interested in this, I don't know why we let our country just say, okay, well, you know what? We don't need that space program.
Well, you know what? It could be because we've already got a colony there.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were talking about Wernher von Braun, are you saying that it was interesting to you that he never got upset about any of the ebb and flow of politics as it impacted the space program because he knew that we were already there? Is that what you're saying?
I think he knew. Because even he never, because think about it. Here's NASA in its prime. All of a sudden they say, okay, well, you know what? Apollo 16, 17, and 18 are all paid for. Is it 17, 18, and 19? I always forget.
Yeah, it's 18, 19, 20, and 21 were paid for.
Okay, that's what it was, yeah. 18, 19, 20, 21. I always get it confused. That's why I always ask. But there was four of them that were paid for that we said, okay. Von Braun didn't even go to Washington to petition anybody.
Let me correct something. Those four were not paid for, but two of them, 18 and 19, were paid for. The crews had already been selected. 18 was already trained and ready to roll. So there were two of them already paid for, and the rockets were built. The spaceships were built, and they canceled.
It's one of them things. I don't know. It was a very suspicious thing to me because when I had wrote to NASA about something else, and while I was writing to them about that, I had asked them about where, because I knew they had built all four ships. I just wanted to know where they were, and I had just asked them, and they actually gave me a list. Huntsville, Houston, Kennedy. I mean, Canaveral, and I can't remember the other one. I think it was in California. And that's not where they are. There's only one I can find is in Huntsville. Mm-hmm. Can't even find the other ones. So it's just something suspicious going on there. And the fact that Von Braun didn't even petition Congress to keep the space program going just amazes me.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that no one really petitioned Congress to keep the space program going amazed me. And I'm thinking, come on, guys. Here you go. You got to go. I think they already knew. I think the head of NASA knew, and I think Von Braun knew, and I think a few people knew.
Well, look,
astronauts.
Remember during Gulf War I, the general on the ground was Norman Schwarzkopf.
Mm-hmm.
He said in a press conference that if Saddam Hussein didn't give up, if he didn't surrender or at least leave Kuwait, if he didn't do that, he said, we've got things to throw at him he cannot begin to imagine. And one of the press corps asked, what are you talking about? And he said You remember during Gulf War I how everybody was awestruck by the smart bombs and smart missiles and all of that. He said, that's obsolete. He said, we've got stuff way beyond that. Okay, apply that to Apollo. By the time we here in the public saw the Apollo program take off and they shot towards the moon, so they say, and walked on the moon, so they say, by the time they did that, that was obsolete technology. I guarantee you, we already had something way beyond chemical burning rockets. I guarantee you that was obsolete by the time we saw it, and we were sitting here awestruck by it when the real stuff was way beyond that. I bet you that's true.
Well, I can tell you this much from being in the Navy when I was in there. And this
you have to do it real quick. We've only got 30 seconds.
Okay. We were working with chips that are considered state-of-the-art today, and that was, well, I was 18, so that was 30-something years ago.
There you go. There you go. Give us your web address real quick.
Oh, guys, www.icar1.com. That'll bring you to everything else.
All right. Stay with me on the line for just a moment. I want to thank you, Joe, for being with us this evening. It's always, always interesting and enlightening when Joe Montaldo is with us. I told you, he is strange and unexplained, and that's what we talked about tonight, the strange and the unexplained. Be sure, if you haven't subscribed to the K-Files, that you do so, okay? Get that done right now. Don't forget it. Don't let it slip. Don't let it get away from you. Subscribe to our free weekly newsletter, because you'll be glad you did, all right? Tomorrow night, another great show, and this one's a wrap. My friend.